Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order March 11th, Wednesday. Time's 1:38. And we've altered the schedule, and I'll get into that in a minute. But with me today is Chair Olson, Chair Hoffman. He'll be here in a minute. He's just in his office. Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, myself, Stedman, and Senator Merrick should be showing up. But we're going to have a couple items on. We didn't finish this morning a presentation from Retirement and Benefits on House Bill 78, which is the retirement system, defined benefit option piece of legislation. We were going to pick that up first thing this afternoon, but apparently they got corked by OMB, Office of Management and Budget, so we're going to move them back. So first up will be a presentation dealing with information technology. We'll finish that presentation, and then we'll go to finishing up this morning's presentation with Retirement and Benefits. And then after Retirement and Benefits, we had Legislative Finance scheduled to talk about the proposed, or House Bill 78, the proposed new defined benefit option. We'll have them tomorrow. So we don't want to have people rushed in these three presentations coming. They're all important. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and have a presentation on the state's IT needs, challenges, and solutions by the Office of Management and Budget and the Office of Information Technology, if they can come forward. That's Ms. Lacey Sanders, who's Director of Management and Budget, and Mr. Bill Smith, Chief Investment Officer, Information Officer for the Office of Information Technology. And if you could, Mr. Smith, I guess you're in the middle chair, so you must be leading the way today. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and tell the committee what you want to tell them.
Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders. I am the Office of Management and Budget Director for the Governor. Thank you for having us today. I do have Director Bill Smith, Chief Information Officer Bill Smith with me today. The request of OMB and the Office of Information Technology has to do with what we're looking at both in the future in how we're modernizing our information technology systems across the state, as well as the budgetary impacts, hence me being here, forward-looking and approaches that we can take to address these large costs that are looming in front of us. So I am going to turn the presentation over to Bill to start off and go from there.
Thank you very much, Lacey, and through the chair. My name is Bill Smith, for the record. I am the State Chief Information Officer and the Director of the Division of Office of Information Technology within the Department of Administration. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk a little bit about the needs in the across the executive branch, across the state for IT modernization. I'll be going over some kind of general concepts and the challenges that we see. And then we can talk a little bit more about some specific things upcoming, and Lacey will be covering that towards the end of the presentation. So by all means, feel free to interrupt me at any point. If you've got any kind of questions, I'll stop also at the end of each slide and kind of work through that.
Well, we'll keep our normal process. We'll let you present your slide, and then we'll take questions at the end of a slide if there is questions.
Okay. Chair Stedman, thank you very much. So when we start to look around the executive branch in terms of modernization, we really are talking about the major systems, the major IT systems that are utilized to provide services to citizens and other constituents throughout the state, throughout state government. It's important to remember as we kind of talk through these that it's really not, I think everyone recognizes, it's not cosmetic work, it's deep foundational work. These systems are extremely complex. And they have many, many components, and any of these components can really be the drivers behind modernization needs. If you look at these systems, typically you're going to have a core business application, which is your software, your program that is designed to perform a specific service. You're going to have user interfaces where people interact with that. You're also going to have the infrastructure that it sits on, the computers that run it. Any of these could be requiring update. Sometimes all of them are requiring update. But the path that we choose to move forward with to do the updates and do the modernization really can depend on what is that specific driver behind it. And as a result, not all of these system updates and modernizations look alike. As a matter of fact, they look very, very different quite often. As we look at each of these components, they can be requiring change because there's mission change, because an agency has a different business need than they did when the system was implemented. It can also be because they're just getting really expensive to operate. We've seen that on mainframe technology and some other areas, or security risk or compliance risk. Regardless of the reason, it's important for us just to kind of recognize why we're doing that and then to target the response to that specific need. And the last thing I would just say on this before opening up to any, if there are any kind of questions on this slide, it really is also important to recognize that these investments, although significant, they're significant because of the significant nature of those systems. These systems are not trivial. They're very complex, and often that results in some significant time and investment money required. If there are no questions, I'll move on to the next slide.
Go ahead and continue on slide number 3.
So when we look at the needs for these modernizations, they typically take a good amount of time and they typically take a good amount of dollars and investment. And that's just directly driven by the complexity. As we look at a lot of these, they may have been around for multiple decades. Business rules behind what they do have often accumulated over time, have often changed over time. But when we start to break it down and try to replace that system, often we have to untangle those business rules. We also have to keep the system running. Very few of these systems can be offline for any significant amount of time. So as we're looking at a modernization, we have to keep the existing system in play and providing all of the services, which sometimes means updating it as we are building the replacement. And so that often results in some duplication of effort. We have teams that are not only building a new system, but they're keeping the old one running. That can be a resource challenge for agencies and for the individuals that are doing that work. The other piece that we run into on many of these is they're very data heavy. They're very data centric, and they have huge databases and huge amounts of information that is accumulated over time. That can really be complex. It can be full of errors. It can be a bit of a challenge in terms of unwinding that and making sure that when we have a new system, the data that we push into it has been cleaned up and been reviewed. That data management alone can take a significant amount of time and energy. The second major bullet up there in terms of project risk reduction is another element that I do want to hit on. Because of the complexity of these systems, the projects themselves incur a lot of risk. They come with a lot of risk. They take a lot of time, and it can be a challenge to get through an entire multi-year system or multi-year project cleanly without running into problems. And so it's important as we move forward on these projects that we do consider those risks and we work to mitigate those. A couple of the areas that we work significantly to take care of those are around organizational change. These systems are integral to the way organizations work, and so when you change a system, a lot of the work processes around them need to change. We also need to be working with the folks that manage those systems so that they fully understand the way that the new system is going to be working. Clear requirements ahead of time is also quite often a challenge. Very often these systems have been around for so long that we sometimes don't have good, clear documentation about why we built them the way we built them. We just know that they work and that we've built and that we want to replace them. And so it's often a challenge to go back and say, let's go ahead and map the requirements to the outcomes that we need so that we don't just try to build a better version of what we have, we actually build one that meets the requirements today and moving forward using best practices. That requires a lot of time-consuming work up front, a lot of documentation work up front, and it can be a significant challenge resource-wise when an agency is trying to continue to move forward with delivering their business needs. As a result of some of those project risks, it really is important for us to have dedicated project professionals helping out with that. Sometimes there's an inclination to think that the IT team that runs the current system can take care of managing the project coming in and moving forward with the replacement. Most of these implementations require a very specific skill set. There are various agencies in the state that have that internal and others that don't, and those are agencies that typically will add that project management, that project governance role to the project moving forward. So you'll sometimes see a project come through with a dollar value to replace it, to build a new system, and then an accompanying dollar value to bring those risk reduction skill sets to that project. It's also a very, very important factor as we're moving forward because these projects can be significantly risky and they can be very expensive if we have a misfire.
We have a question if you're done with the slide.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, that's sort of the ideal. Bring on an IT project manager who knows what they're doing. A lot of those floating around, free to hire, or are they a little bit hard to come by? You don't keep a stable of them for agencies to use, do you?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, we don't have a stable of them, but we do have a number of industry partners that we routinely work with on project management, and we bring them on periodically for projects. There are a lot of IT project managers and companies that focus on that around and available. The real challenge that we have is making sure that you have the right one with the right project. Their IT projects are not all the same, both in size and scale and scope. For instance, if you have a project that is heavily involved with the financial sector, say, you know, around permanent fund dividend, those types of things, tax, those systems are unique, and so you want to get an IT project manager that has experience in that world and with those controls. So there can be challenges getting the right one for the larger projects, but in general, IT project management capabilities can be found in the private sector pretty readily.
Okay.
Just, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, they also have to speak government.
Any other questions on this slide? Okay, we'll go on to the next slide. Slide number 4, please.
So the challenges that we run into, in addition to some of those general IT implementation risks that I mentioned, often revolve around the various aspects of these systems. And by that, I mean you've got the core mission system. You've got challenges for the core platform or software. It may be an extremely old system that speaks an antiquated language, and I've often kind of heard it referred to as trying to translate something from Latin into modern vernacular English. A lot can be lost in translation, and when you're dealing with a very sophisticated IT system, if you lose a little piece in translation, it can have big effects downstream. So that's one of the things, particularly with, for instance, mainframe technology, that causes those projects to be very timely and have a significant amount of risk because it does take a lot to make sure that you're translating that language appropriately and you're not missing out on any details. There are other areas as well in terms of constituent employee services. These systems don't exist in a vacuum, and so we also have to make sure that we care for the people side of replacing a system and making sure that the consumers and the folks that use the system on a daily basis or manage it are very comfortable with it. They understand it, and we prepare them for it. That change management with the various stakeholders is critical for success of a project. You can have a good IT project implementation, and if people don't understand how to use it, it can be a real disaster. And so caring for the people side of things is also important. And the final thing that I'll call out on this particular slide is the internal operations. Oftentimes, we replace major systems because they're outdated or they're long in the tooth, and it requires us to upskill our teams and make sure that our teams understand maybe a new technology, maybe a new programming language, maybe just a new process flow, not only within but also adjacent to that replaced system. So the internal operations and how it fits in the organization is something that we also need to be very careful that we care for and adds time and complexity to these projects.
Any questions on the slide? Okay, next slide, please.
So within the executive branch, the way that these projects come forward is that they originate with the responsible agency. So in our environment, line of business or systems that are specific to particular agencies are owned and run and operated by those agencies. If a system is involved in enterprise-wide use, and so it's something that everybody uses, you think about a cloud environment, server hosting, our day-to-day productivity suite, things like that, Office of Information Technology, my team is responsible for the lifecycle management. As I talked about the various kind of components of these major systems, there can be crossover as well. So, for instance, line of business systems, you may have an application that needs to be modernized, but it might ride on infrastructure that Office of Information Technology manages. And so it's a collaborative effort, but in general, the departments are the ones that are bringing forward the recommendations for modernization with their systems, and the Office of Information Technology does for enterprise systems. It typically is integrated into the budget process, and so that's where it comes forward, and Office of Management and Budget manages that as the budget is formulated. But we do, at a couple critical points, we do have an investment review board that looks at all IT expenditures over $25,000, and that is typically at the request for proposal and at the contract stage of a new project. And that review is brought on board to look at security implications, to make sure that the system that is going to be replaced or the system that's going to be brought on board can be integrated into our environment. It meets our standards. All of those types of elements, we do a review on that as well. It's also significant to note, I think, that we're going to be expanding that. We're working on updating that process to streamline it, to make it less burdensome on the departments, but also provide more value, while at the same time collecting more data so that we can continue to flesh out our enterprise-wide view of our IT environment. That is work that is ongoing and not totally complete, but for the past several years we have had the investment review board that has been reviewing these expenditures. The other aspect that I wanted to highlight that was initiated this year with this budget cycle is an IT Application Modernization Council. It's modeled after the Facility Council that you're probably familiar with, run over in the Department of Transportation. And it's really intended to try to prioritize at the entire executive branch level systems that need to be modernized, and just to be another data point that goes into the budget formulation process. This year it was a little bit of expedited because of timing, and we put it together just a couple months before the budget was due to be built. This next year for fiscal 28, we are starting here shortly with it. It's got representation by the agencies. Agencies bring their recommendations forward for system modernization, and it gets evaluated by a panel that looks at the how significant that system is within the mission delivery. It looks at the IT system itself, how out of date is it, or what are the challenges that are driving modernization. And then it also looks at the specific need of that department, how critical is that system to what they do, and then puts together a rating matrix, and then we provide that prioritized list to the Office of Management and Budget, just as another data point within the budgetary process. So that is going to be I think as we continue to modernize that or continue to develop that council, it's going to provide a lot of good information to the Office of Management and Budget to augment what the agencies bring forward in the budgetary process. If there are no questions on this, I'll move to the next slide. I also wanted to highlight some of the recent successes and recent over the last several years that we've had in terms of modernization. I think it's important to recognize the work that's been going on within the government to modernize our information technology environment. I'll start off just briefly talking a little bit about cloud adoption in general. And that started well before our rapid cloud migration project that was kicked off about 4 or 5 years ago. A few years before that, there was a direct movement towards an intentional movement towards software as a service, which is taking advantage of software that is provided in a cloud environment, either our cloud or an agent or a third party's cloud. But what that does is it allows you to free yourself from having to modernize that infrastructure, having to modernize the equipment that the program runs on. And so that in itself removes some technical debt and removes some legacy modernization requirements from the state. We continue to follow that up with our rapid cloud migration, which again moved from on-premise equipment and moved it into a cloud environment. The real benefit from the cloud environment, in addition to some security aspects, is that you basically have an evergreen environment. The vendor, the partner that you're working with that maintains and provides that equipment that your software rides on, keeps it up to date. They modernize it as they go. It takes one thing off of our plate. We still manage it, and we can go ahead, and there are certain elements of that equipment that we can modernize. But for the most part, the modernization requirements now transfer. It's a shared responsibility that transfers to that provider. And so it allows us to focus on the application as well as some other key elements of that. And it also reduces the amount of modernization costs we have downstream, because as we modernize these platforms that are in the cloud, we don't have to worry about modernizing the equipment at the same time. One thing I do want to say about cloud migration is it does not totally replace or eliminate the lifecycle management requirement. We still have, as I said, there are several components on these systems. We still have to manage and modernize periodically those software platforms, the actual program itself that rides on the cloud environment. And we also, if we move things to the cloud, we can modernize within the cloud. And so, for instance, we did a rapid lift and shift as part of that project. We moved a lot of our programs without changing the programs into a cloud environment, which took care of that infrastructure, took care of the equipment. But now those systems are going to still need the programs to be modernized over time. And so all of those drivers that require modernization would do the same thing for those cloud programs. So it's not just a one and done, but it does reduce the cost and reduce the effort that we have to put forward in modernizing those systems in the future. One of the other elements that I wanted to highlight from an enterprise perspective is our cybersecurity infrastructure. We have had a deliberate modernization effort over the last several years of our cybersecurity platforms, and we've not only expanded coverage for the executive branch, but we've also modernized many. We've decommissioned a number of more senior or older platforms, and as a result, we've had a direct improvement in our cybersecurity performance and a corollary reduction in critical incidents within the executive branch. The modern systems are a little bit more tailored and able to defend against modern threats. So it's just another example of the fact that we need to continue to modernize these things because of the environment around us, in addition to just the service that it provides. The last thing I want to highlight is an example of a great agency line of business modernization project. You may very well be familiar with the Department of Public Safety Criminal Justice Information System modernization, just completed within the past several weeks. Long-term project, very expansive project, a very long list of stakeholders. The Department of Public Safety did a great job with this project, with their industry partners, collaborating with Office of Information Technology, where we had overlapping responsibilities, some of our networking responsibilities, et cetera. But it was a great example of a project that, while extremely complex, was managed well. And they had some challenges, as all projects do, but they worked through them and they were able to go live. And that project has not only created a better performing system, but it's also removed the criminal justice information system elements from mainframe technology, which in and of itself is a big deal. And so those projects are often fraught with risk, and they did a great job with that. So that one is a great example of a project that a five-year project took a long time. It was expensive, but it was well done, and they did a great job on it.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, can you talk to us a little bit more about the cloud adoption? I know that in the private sector, there was massive adoption of move to the cloud. In the last year and a half, a lot of big companies are finding that they went too far too fast, and they're shifting certain things. Nobody's shifting everything, but certain things back on premises or to proprietary servers. My understanding is that the state is on a whole lot of stuff still way behind where the private sector ever got to. Can you talk to us about how your office and how you're helping agencies make sure that we hit the window rather than overshoot and pull back?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, absolutely. Our approach when we did the rapid migration, and for clarification, our rapid migration project did not involve modernizing the applications, the programs themselves. It involved moving them from on-premise equipment to cloud-based equipment, so we modernized the infrastructure that they run on. And that's an important point because, as I indicated, some of those applications still need to modernize to other cloud-provided tools and other ways of doing business within the cloud. But our approach was to do a 100% review of our servers and our applications across the enterprise, and then make a decision on what could technically go to the cloud and also what should go to the cloud. So part of our process was to try to take a good cut at that very issue. Should things go to the cloud? And so as a result, we moved a good majority of our servers, and we shut down a lot of servers, but there were also programs and servers that were left on premise, some of them because they were going to be going to the cloud through a modernization or through another path, but some of them just because they made sense to keep on premise. And so as a result, today we have a hybrid environment. So we've got two different cloud environments at the enterprise level. We've got Microsoft Azure and Oracle because they do different things well. And then we also have data centers on premise and at a couple different places in the state that we have shrunken, but still serve a purpose appropriately. So I think the difference in our approach and what the industry, some places did within private industry, is that we had seen a little bit of that. And so as we went through this migration, we did our best to take a look and make a value judgment ahead of time so we didn't have to roll things back on premise. So I think we're in a pretty good position there as a state. But it is absolutely, in my mind, it's a concern that you want to make sure that you're using the right tool for the right job. And cloud is no different.
Just a quick follow-up. If I may, is that something that your investment review board helps agencies work through, look through, or how does that analysis get done outside OIT?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that is a function of the investment review board. When a project comes to the investment review board, first off, we do have a cloud smart policy in the state, which basically says if it makes sense to go to the cloud as a priority. If not, then you can leave it on premise or develop it on premise. Part of what the IRB does is look at the department's or the agency's intended path and say, that makes sense, or, you know, hey, this is a duplication of services, or this is something that ought to go to the cloud that you're not planning on. And we have those discussions with the agencies. That is something we do today. I think we're going to do it better as we modernize that process because we're trying to introduce that discussion earlier in the procurement cycle so that agencies aren't very far down the path before they come to that IRB. So we're more of a value add to the agencies and kind of help them ideate on the way to move forward. But that is definitely part of the conversation with the IRB are they going in the right path? And we have those conversations with them.
We'll go to the next slide. So this is the slide that you actually came here to tell us about. The slide with the money request?
To the chair, it is, and this is the slide that I'm going to hand off to Lacey, Sander, to brief, and I'm certainly available to kick in as needed.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Again, for the record, my name is Lacey Sanders, Director for the Office of Management and Budget. And yes, this is the exciting slide for the Finance Committee, or maybe. So I want to preface my remarks today with I am not an IT expert. This is not my area of expertise in any way. So I have many, many lifelines in addition to Director Bill Smith on the phone today. From my experience in this role, I came in and almost had a sticker shock moment, right? Departments would come to the Office of Management and Budget with system replacement needs that quite frankly, are very large dollar value costs. And knowing that my expertise is not in IT, myself and Bill have come up with a process using the Modernization Council to evaluate these costs and try to come up with a way for us to capture future needs through a running list and also to rank those through that facility, similar to the Facility Council process, as a way for the Office of Management and Budget to really be able to understand where the highest level priorities are. What I will share is that this list before the committee is not all-inclusive of agencies' needs. There are probably, providing this presentation today is going to bring other departments to come out of the woodwork and bring their items to OMB that are maybe percolating down below or in, in a division or in a department. The projects that are on the slide before us for these four agencies are ones that have been reoccurring conversations surrounding these projects. They're in various stages. For example, with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and their Unemployment Insurance Mainframe System Modernization Project, they have been working through, the process of evaluating what does that look like for our state? Are there other systems across the nation that can be utilized? So they have provided an estimate of $58 million that estimate may be outdated by the time that we actually move forward with a project. The way we have addressed projects in the state has really been by, a case-by-case basis. It hasn't really been an organized approach, and generally the projects that we see coming forward are those that have maybe a large federal component with a smaller match that the state is putting forward funding for through that unrestricted general funds, or we have receipt-based projects. So whether that's in the Division of Retirement and Benefits or in most recently we had a project before the legislature for the Dividend Application Information System, the DIAS system that was, there are other revenue sources that are paying for those systems. So those are the systems that maybe move forward more quickly because of it's a little more palatable on the cost to put those forward. I didn't put these in priority order today on the slide, but I will note that one that has frequently been discussed as of late, and we are trying every avenue to determine a way forward, including working with the federal congressional delegation, is the Department of Family and Community Services online resource for children of Alaska, or our ORCA system. This system is incredibly antiquated, as well we have federal guidance that this system needs to be replaced, or we may be facing potential fines and penalties for the lack of compliance under this system. We are looking at avenues of potentially trying to obtain federal receipt authority to offset some of the cost associated with this system. Again, to my point earlier, a lot of these, it's as they come up to the top, we have issues that we are facing in a department. We try to address the system replacement very quickly. And as Director Bill Smith shared earlier, a lot of these systems take a significant amount of time. Another example that we've all recently been privy to is the Division of Public Assistance System and the significant investment that was placed in that system to get, the modernization effort completed. That process is still underway, and I know we're looking for a future deadline of when that will be up and running 100%. I need to check my notes to see if I got a response to that earlier question from the committee. But it's a lot of effort and a lot of moving parts when it comes to the funding sources to fund what is on the horizon for administrative components related to information technology. And, Senator or Chair Stedman, we in a separate conversation had talked about how this isn't the most exciting topic to bring forward, but it is important and critical to ensuring that our departments can continue to serve the constituents across the state, and we can get things like benefits out to individuals or making sure that we're tracking all of the children under the care of the Department of Family and Community Services. So with that, I will be happy to take questions.
Okay, maybe payroll. TBD, what does that stand for?
Chair Stedman, the committee members may be aware there was a recent request for information published by the Department of Administration. We continue to face challenges in the world of payroll, not only specific to time and attendance, but to the entire payroll processing system in the state. That request for information is looking for a broader, comprehensive payroll either system or process to be put into place so that we can ensure that we are, not taking significant amount of time to process individuals' payroll, that the payroll is getting completed accurately and timely. And we should have more information regarding that system at the close of the RFI.
And then funding. Are you, since how you're sitting in front of the money committee, how do you plan on paying for this, and over what time frame, and in what order of priority, or so we have more detail? Because this seems like just an introduction today that you do have a IT problem, or financial challenge. So we hear that part of the argument, but the financial implementation, mm-hmm. How do you perceive that?
Chair Stedman, it's a conversation we continue to have at this table. Resources are incredibly limited, and given our fiscal environment, it's difficult to bring forward a $58 million project to the committee when we know we have competing needs across the state. The Office of Management and Budget is looking at other options that might be available to us. That includes potentially putting forward a bond or, continuing to do things like we spoke about or I spoke about earlier with the online resources for Children's Alaska, the ORCA system, trying to find out whether we can advocate to the federal government to help support that cost. But these are very large costs, and timing-wise, they're very close on the horizon to being needing to be replaced. Whether that means in this fiscal year or next fiscal year, we need to weigh those options or those factors to determine what options are going to be available.
Okay. Normally, if we do bonds, we do capital projects, and we're investing in hard assets that will have a life quite a bit further than the amortization of the debt or the bonds. So one of the questions is, on these items, how much of these dollars are going to be in infrastructure that's going to outlive the life of a bond, if we were to look in that direction?
Chair Stedman, that is something we're going to have to evaluate on each one of the projects. I anticipate, the investment cost is of a system, and the system replacement is going to be, have a life expectancy. I don't have that information as far as today about each one. But we can definitely, you know, prioritize that in our review if a decision was made to move forward with the bond.
So are you going to – do you plan on coming forward to the Finance Committee with a request or an amendment to the capital budget for FY 27 to include any of this? Or is that still out in the future?
Chair Stedman, I would say that that's still out into the future at this point. Again, the intention behind the presentation today was to bring awareness to the committee. But, you know, with resources being limited as they are, we are trying, as the administration is trying, to balance the needs, but while recognizing that there are future costs that are going to be coming towards us.
Right. So I think the committee would most likely be reluctant to put tens of millions of dollars down on the table in the budget without a direct request from the administration, because the chances of it surviving the veto pen I don't think would be likely. So we would be looking to your department to make recommendations for inclusion in the budget, and I think we'd take a pretty hard look at if there was a bond request that it actually had a life substantially longer than the bonds, because that would just compound the problem if it was much shorter than the life of a bond.
Yeah, Chair Stedman, we will definitely take that into consideration. And, you know, to your remarks earlier about, you know, amendments coming before the committee, at this point, our fiscal situation, you know, continues to be unstable. We are continuing to watch the price of oil and the volatility of that oil. Mm-hmm. From the administration's perspective and from the governor's perspective, without a fiscal plan at this point, mm-hmm. it's unlikely that, a request for several hundred million dollars would just be added to the budget.
Okay. Well, I don't think we're going to do a comprehensive fiscal plan between now and May. I think that's unlikely, although we're going to be working on component parts of it. Do we have questions? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I appreciate this presentation. As some know, I'm a big fan of strengthening our IT project management. And one of the things that I do a lot of reading on is artificial intelligence and its potential displacement of labor, especially in the intellectual property arena. So coding, and I mean, you can pretty much tell it to build you a website now. And with agents, it can actually go out, procure the domain, and with access to crypto, it could fund the dang thing and actually put it all together for you. So just wondering, are we addressing both the risk and the potential efficiencies that are emerging with that? There's a great deal of obsolescence risk in what we're doing if we kind of overbuild for, you know, the current century while we're already leaping into the next one almost as far as IT goes. So could you just maybe speak a little bit about what we're doing to keep that risk horizon clear right now with the rapidly emerging capability and the potential displacement of you don't necessarily have to have a lot of hardware if you're in the cloud. And as you say, the cloud's being constantly updated, and you're pretty much just accessing it with a portal, and you don't have a lot of onboard processing that you're doing. It's pretty much up there. So are we on the power curve with that, or are we potentially going to fall behind with investments we make that aren't properly queued up for what's coming?
For the record, again, Bill Smith, State Chief Information Officer, and through the Chair, Senator Kaufman, I think we're in a good spot. With our cloud investments, we have really tapped into that evergreen environment, which is where the AI tools are being developed. And we have focused, at this point, from an enterprise perspective, we've focused on those AI tools that we have access to either in our cloud environment or through our productivity suite. So, for instance, our email, et cetera, we have the ability to utilize, and we can license, and we've got a little over 1,000 licenses of an AI agent that allows you to get some help when you're generating emails or when you're reviewing emails or documents, et cetera. By leveraging the cloud environment, we have not had a major AI project with a lot of infrastructure or anything along those lines, but we've really made some significant progress in exposing and providing AI tools to our employees across the state, whether it's a safe chatbot that is in our state infrastructure so we don't have to worry about information leaking to the public domain, which like you do with public tools, or those AI agents that are associated with our productivity suite, the co-pilots. But we've also, because of our cloud environment, we've also got the ability to go in and build AI tools. We've got several proofs of concept, and there are a couple instances where AI tools are moving to production to do things like, review written documents to get information that might be entered in the margin of a written document, but it was never really captured in the data. The tools go in, they read that, they can organize that data and make it accessible to our employees. So there are things like that that we're doing, and I think we're doing it in a considered fashion. We're not doing anything exotic, not doing anything extremely expensive or anywhere where I would consider it to be kind of on the bleeding edge of technology. But we're focused on those things that help us get kind of the smaller but significant efficiencies across a larger spread of our employees and help take some of those, just let them benefit from it.
That's fine. Let's keep moving on here.
Thank you.
We're going to run out of time. Ms. Lacey, you want to finish up? I think this is your last slide.
Yeah, Chair Stedman, this is the last slide. I'm happy to take any additional questions surrounding, like I said, we do have expertise if somebody is interested in talking about a specific IT program that was listed. I'm happy to make connections or follow up for the committee.
Yeah, that would be good. You can follow up individually. I think we'll have this probably back before us when you actually have a request, and we'll probably have some preliminary discussions before then. But all the committee members are kind of put on notice that this is out there. We're well aware of it because we've heard of complaints and concerns. I would like to thank you for coming in this afternoon to do your presentation. And I'll sit down in my chair if you hand me a capital request in the hundreds of millions before you hand it to me. Next up, Kathy Lee, Division of Retirement and Benefits, if she can come forward. We're going to move in and continue our presentation on House Bill 78. I think we have after they introduce themselves for the record, I think we have a clarification for the record. And then we'll pick up on slide 15. If we go back one slide, 15 is kind of the start of that, and 15 will be a kind of a repeat, so everybody's on the same page. So you guys can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and clarify the one misspeak earlier and continue on.
For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
And for the record, I'm Christopher Novell. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Okay.
And to the clarification, this is relating to the post-retirement pension adjustment. So through the chair to Senator Keel, when I answered your question, partly right, 50% of inflation is from age 64 to 65. After 65, it's 75% of inflation.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So then we'll go on and start off with, we got a half hour and a couple of slides, so go ahead and walk us through slide 15. And for those watching at home, they can watch the meeting this morning, which brought the first part of this presentation, and then this will be the continuation of this morning's meeting. So go ahead and continue.
So, yeah, we left off on slide 15, and we asked the question where state contributions projected to increase, and we showed this box here, which gave two reasons to the additional state contributions. So there is due to the higher cost of HB benefits, HB 78 benefits, the actuarial determined contribution rate will expect it to increase if HB 78 is enacted. Also, the current rate of the ADC already exceeds the statutory employment rates, employer rates of 22% for PERS, 12.56% of TERS, and therefore the ADC rate will for HB 78 will increase. And moving to state as employer contributions, the state always pays the entire ADC rate. So
let's lose the acronyms.
Sorry.
Okay. So remember, you're speaking to the people at home. So. So tell us what happens over 22%, the cap.
So the 22% relates to the statutory employer rate, which by statute we have to pay for PERS and 12.56 for TERS. The actuarially determined contribution is the amount that needs to be paid, which will also include, is over and above, to pay down the unfunded liability. In the case of the state as employer contributions, they simply pay the entire actuarially determined cost rate to pay down the unfunded liability and past service cost.
And it's 22.55, I think, this year. Excuse me, 27.55, I think. If I recall.
It is, to the chair, it is 27.55, and.
Okay.
So moving on, the next three slides are table-based. We tried to simplify them. We've moved them to dollars instead of percentages for the audience, but still these need good explanation. So if we can defer to David Kirshner, our principal actuary, who should be on the line.
Yes. Mr. Kirshner, I see you are online. If you can help us with slide 16, after you introduce yourself.
All right. Good afternoon. David Kirshner, actuary from Gallagher. As Chris mentioned on the last two slides, there's two key reasons why state contributions are projected to increase, and these next few slides show an example, and we've chosen FY 2030, which is essentially 5 years after HB 78 would have been effective had it passed last year. So I will walk through slide 16. Slide 16 is showing the state as an employer contribution for PERS, and as Chris mentioned, the state as an employer pays the 100% of the actuarially determined contribution rate based on the pay of its employees, which is roughly 50% of the total PERS payroll. So you can see the first line, we've shown you all of these figures are in millions. So we've shown you the total projected pay for FY 2030. And the reason why it is projected to increase in the HB 78 column is because we are expecting higher or increased employee retention under HB 78, so we have more higher paid people in the workforce under our HB 78 projection. So that's why total pay is projected to increase. So the first in the current column, we've got basically two cost components, the current defined benefit plan, DB acronym, the current defined benefit plan, and then the defined contribution retirement plan costs, or the DCR costs. So the current defined benefit plan, there's three components to the actuarial costs. The normal cost is the cost of benefits that we expect to accrue in the upcoming year, and that's paid for every year. And we have both pension normal cost and healthcare normal cost. They're $16 million each. And then we have the past service cost, which is the paying down the unfunded liability in the current year of $274 million. So the current defined benefit costs are projected to be $306 million. And then the DCR, defined contribution retirement costs, are projected to be $109 million. And that $109 million covers the four benefits that Chris mentioned on I believe it was slide 14, the occupational death and disability benefits, the health care benefits, the defined contribution payment made by the employers, and the 3% HRA, health reimbursement account contribution. So those four components add up to the 109. So, and of course, in the current column, we don't have any HB 78 costs. So the total projected state as an employer contribution currently is projected to be $415 million. Then we move to the HB 78 column, and we have the same defined benefit costs. And you can see they're slightly lower. And the reason for that is because currently we have in our current valuation assumptions, we have a rehire load because we historically have been seeing former retirees coming back to work and starting to accrue benefits. And so we instituted what we call a rehire load for those rehires. Under HB 78, because we are would be reopening the defined benefit plans to new hires, the thinking is that there will be less rehires coming back to work. So for the HB 78 projections, we've removed that rehire load. So that's why the current defined benefit normal costs decreased slightly because of that lower or because of the elimination of the rehire load. So the total defined benefit costs under HB 78 are projected to be $302 million. There's no projected DCR costs, defined contribution retirement, because all of the active employees are assumed to elect to transfer into the defined benefit plan, and the defined contribution retirement plans continue to be overfunded. So there would be no post HB 78 costs for DCR, defined contribution retirement. Then we move down to the three components of the HB 78 costs. There's the cost for pension benefits, cost for health care benefits, and the health reimbursement, or HRA, which is, in this case, 4% for PERS, peace officers and firefighters, and 3% for other employees. So the HB 78 costs are projected to be $151 million. And you add down, you get 453.
Okay,
any questions?
Any questions on this slide? Okay, we'll go to the next slide, slide 17.
All right. Slide 17 is developing the additional state contribution for PERS. Now, in this case, because we just went through the portion of the PERS employees that are employed by the state, this is for all non-state employers, and all non-state employers pay 22% of pay. So the total pay is projected to increase because of our expected retention. The current defined benefit costs are for the non-state employers are $308 million. We haven't shown the components, but it's the same components that we just went through. And again, under HB 78, slightly lower, $304 million because of the elimination of that rehire load. The defined contribution retirement costs, again, covering the same four benefits for the non-state employers, $110 million and zero under HB 78. And then the HB 78 costs, including the health reimbursement account contributions, are projected to be $152 million. So when you add those three components, you get $418 million currently versus $456. That's the total cost. Then the next row shows how much the non-state employers pay, and in both cases it's 22%. So it's just 22% times the top line total pay figure, $315 versus $332. then we subtract the statutory employer contribution. I'm sorry, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So we subtract the statutory employer contribution from the total cost to get the portion paid by the state, and we have two lines there, before adjustment and after interest adjustment. That's because the additional state contributions are typically paid at the beginning of the year, so we back out the half-year interest that we added to get the total cost. So the additional state contribution for PERS is projected to increase from $99 million to $120 million for FY 2030.
Okay.
And if there are no questions, we can move on to slide 18, which is exactly the same information, except this is for TERS, the additional state contributions, and we have a similar story, the total cost, the current defined benefit, and the DCR, defined contribution retirement cost for TERS employers, for TERS employees, is $278 million, of which the employers paid 12.56%, which is $103 million, leaving $175 million for the state, and then we back out the interest to get $169 million. Then we move to the HB 78 column. Again, the current DB costs go down slightly because of the removal of that rehire load. We don't have any DCR costs after HB 78. The AP TERS HB 78 costs, again, for pension, health care, and the health group, the 3% health reimbursement account, is projected to be $81 million, total of $285 minus the 12.56% that the employers pay, which is $107, leaves $178 for the state, backing out the interest, half year interest, we get to $172. So the TERS additional state contribution is projected to increase from $169 to $172 million.
Okay, next slide, 19.
Now, moving on to slide 19, there are a lot of numbers on here, and I apologize, but this is illustrating basically the same information, but in a different way. And I'd like to call your attention, it's just a couple of rows that I want to call your attention to. If you look at the fourth line down, we have the DCR costs for occupational death and disability health care, defined contribution, and health reimbursement account. Again, for PERS, that's currently projected to be $110 million. And then the next row down, under the HB 78 costs, you can see for the HB 78 members, that's projected to be $152 million. So the employers, instead of paying $110 million on behalf of the members in the DCR plan, are projected to pay $152 million on behalf of covered as an HB 78 member. And because they're still paying 22% in both cases, because they're paying more toward the HB 78 than they are the DCR, there's less of their 22% going toward the legacy defined benefit service cost, which is paying down the unfunded liability. So you can see currently they're projected to contribute toward that unfunded liability $173 million versus $151 million under HB 78. Then we move to the next three section of titled the legacy defined benefit past service costs. The total amount is the same in both cases, $275 million. The employer portion, which is the third from the third line from above, $173 million, decreases by $22 million to $151 million. So the state portion increases by that $22 million decrease from $102 to $124. And this is critical to understand, like I said, a lot of numbers here, but basically because the HB 78 costs are higher than the DCR costs, That means the employers are contributing less toward the legacy defined benefit unfunded liability, and therefore the state has to pick up that shortfall that the employers are not paying for the legacy defined benefit unfunded liability. And then in the next two columns, we have for TERS, and it's a similar story. If you look at the DCR line, you see $73 million versus $81 million for HB 78, which means the portion that they pay toward, that the TERS employers pay toward the legacy defined benefit past service costs decreases from $10 million to $7 million. So then we go to the next section. The total legacy defined benefit past service costs remains at $185 million. The portion paid by the employers decreases from 10 to 7, which is a $3 million decrease. So the state's portion increases by that $3 million, just like we just saw with PERS. And then, again, we back out the half-year adjustment to get the increase from $169 million to $172
million. Okay.
And then the next two columns are just adding the PERS and TERS columns together.
So then the total...
And that...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish
your slide. Well, I was just going to say that that's all I wanted to point out from this slide. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay, and then to... Maybe you can help clarify it. The shift, one of the questions is the liability shift to the state. From the non-state employers?
Yes. In the second section there, the legacy defined benefit past service costs, it's $275 million in both cases. That's the portion that's paid, that's the full actuarial cost of paying down the unfunded liability in FY 2030. Currently, the employers pay, of that $275, the non-state employers within PERS pay $173 of the $275, so the state pays $102, the difference. And then under HB 78, portion paid by the employers decreases to $151, so the portion paid by the state has to increase to make up that decrease.
And what is that?
So it's a shifting of the employer's contribution between DCR and HB 78 costs, and therefore there's less money to go toward the legacy defined benefit past service costs.
Okay, could you, Ms. Lee, can you help clarify what he's telling us?
Mr. Chair, when the legacy DB plans were closed, there was an effort not to treat them as closed plans. And the way we did that was there is a portion of the employer contribution that once the DCR obligations are fulfilled, whatever's left over between that and the cap of 22% is paid towards the unfunded liability. So there's still some payment from employers going into the legacy DB plans to help pay that liability down. And right now with the DCR plans, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but I think the total cost of a DCR employee is about 17%, or is it lower?
Sorry.
So okay.
For the chair, I'm not sure.
That's fine. The total cost for the DC plan member is lower than what the cost will be for the HB 78 member. So once the employer pays their obligations, if the bill passes, to the HB 78 employee, there's less money going to the unfunded liability. So because the state is on the hook for the liability for the legacy plans, that means the state has to pay more in that year to make the appropriate payment to the unfunded liability. So I'm just going to use an example here because right now my brain is not telling me what these actual contributions are. But so let's say the DCR contribution is 15%. That means after the obligations are done for that employee, we subtract 15% from the 22%, that's the capped employer rate, and then that amount gets paid into the unfunded liability. But let's say now for the HB 78 member, that amount is now, I forgot what I said, it's now 5 points higher than that. So once we subtract from the 22% cap, that means the state has to pay that additional 5% that the employer didn't pay through the additional contributions that the state is required to pay. So this, I think, is kind of a hidden cost of the HB 78 bill, because the contribution rate will be higher, less will be going from the employer to pay off the unfunded liability.
Senator Hoffman.
Can you give us an example of a monetary example of how much we're talking about on an annual basis, say for this year?
I can't give, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I can't give you that off.
You get that to us.
But we can get that to you. We'll line it out to where it makes a little bit more sense.
Thank you.
Right. We've had that brought to our attention several times, and it is kind of a abstract thing sometimes to grab your head around. But with that 22% cap, the non-state employees are basically blocked from having to pay more, and anything that's over that falls in the lap of the state.
Yes.
Forever.
Forever, till it's paid off. We have other comments, points you want to?
I do.
Okay.
Just in closing, the summary of our presentation here is what we wanted to show was that the design of a DB pension plan needs to be considered when you're looking at standing up a new plan, because the DB plan and this DB plan as well, HB 78, will accrue unfunded liability at some point. HB 78 has levers to take care of some of that, but at some point those levers will tap out and it will start to gain unfunded liability because it's a DB plan and that's part of the DB plan structure. You can't control investments, you can't control inflation, and you can't control how long people live. So as long as those three items can change, and they will likely change for the worse than the better. Some of them might be better at some times, but over time, it will accrue unfunded liability. Pension plans mature at about, DB pension plans mature about 25 to 30 years in. And you can see that with the history of the legacy plans. Just look at PERS. It was created in 1962, but by 1986, it had accrued enough liability that there needed to be cost containment measures put in to keep the costs down. And those cost containment measures were not enough because we had to do it again in 96, and then we totally changed plans in 2006. So the division is neutral on this bill. Whatever you pass, we'll administer. But we want to make sure that you understand all the effects that can happen. And the biggest one were these last slides, and that is the effect on the state budget because of the additional state contributions that will come back to the state to pay, because the 22% the employer pays, the excess is now less because the new HB 78 contributions are more than the defined contribution plan, so that leaves less to go to the unfunded liability. So basically, yeah, that's our presentation.
Okay, I just got a quick comment on that time frame, because it's been, you know, we've been through several iterations. The current plan is about 20 years old.
Yes.
And I don't think we start at time zero if we decide to go to a defined benefit plan and wait 30 years for the first retirees, because if the people roll over or convert, the current employees that have been in there 20 years or 15 years, their time frame to year 30 is not 30 years from now.
Mr. Chair, the comment I made was that was when the plan would mature. While mm-hmm. we start having retirements, and in this case, from what we can see on who's eligible to convert and then retire within the next 2 years, those retirements will likely be within the structure of HB 78. But all the new people coming in, the bulk of the retirees will hit in between 25 and 30 years from now. That's when you'll see how this plan really works.
And that's about the time we get our unfunded liability paid off.
Yep.
Anyway, just coincidence in time, I guess. Do we have questions for the department? Senator Keel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it's a question for the actuary, since we have him on the line. It was a heck of an indictment of his profession there. Mr. Kirshner, do actuaries build these assumptions and contribution rates to guarantee unfunded liabilities at 20 to 30 years?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question, please?
Thank you. The question was, do actuaries build in the assumptions, the calculations, set the contribution rates so that unfunded liabilities are guaranteed at 20 to 30 years out?
Through the chair, well, as we know, there are no guarantees with any of our calculations, because we're making assumptions about future experience. But under the assumption that future experience will match our assumptions, including a 7.25% investment return, et cetera, we are projecting currently that the both PERS and TERS pension trust will be fully funded by 2039. Now, we know that actual or reality is not going to match our assumptions. In some cases, we're going to have better experience than we assumed, and in some cases, we're going to have worse experience than we assumed. But on average, we should have both positive and negative canceling out. But to run projections, we are currently projecting fully funded by 2039, but if future experience is worse than we are expecting, then that's going to be pushed out further and further under the on-board's funding policy. So we take that into account, but we also know that we can't predict the future with absolute certainty.
Otherwise, we'd still be under Tier 1. We would never have had a problem. So, Ms. Lee.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to state that when the actuary values the system, they do it for a one-year period so that we're paying the normal cost that has developed for that year. And then every 4 years, they change their assumptions that they use to match what's happening currently. So any unfunded liability that occurs usually doesn't happen in, boom, 1 year. you can usually see the trend coming. Now, you can have the perfect storm like we had back in 2000, where we had an actuary mistake, we had low returns, and we had an inability to adjust the employer rate because we'd capped them. And those are the three reasons why our funding went from 100% down to, I think, 69% PERS. So it can happen quickly, but usually you'll start seeing the trend coming before the actual tip-over point.
I got a question for Mr. Gallagher. Could you help us with that cost shift question with the higher normal cost of HB 50, or 78 with the 22% cap? And do you have a rough dollar amount for FY 30 or thereabouts?
Yes, through the chair. If we look at slide 19, we'll look at the PERS columns, the first two columns. So the 22% of projected payroll is the total there, the $315 million, the number that's in bold. That's the 22%. That 22% is allocated, $16 million is for the pension normal cost, $15 million is allocated for the healthcare normal cost, $110 million is for the defined contribution retirement costs. That leaves $173 million to pay down toward the defined benefit unfunded liability. Then we move on to the HB 78 column. 22% of the slightly higher projected payroll is $332 million. That $332 million is allocated, again, first to the pension and healthcare normal costs, in this case, 13 and 16. Then $152 million is allocated toward the HB 78 costs. That leaves $151 million of the 22% to go toward the legacy defined benefit past service costs. So the portion paid by the employers toward the unfunded liability decreases by $22 million from $173 million to $151 million. And under the statutory funding framework, whatever the employers don't pay toward the unfunded liability, the state pays by the additional state contribution. So because the portion paid by the employers decreases by $22 million, the portion paid by the state increases by $22 million because the total portion, the total amount is the same, $275 million. Okay. So that's how there's a shifting of how the 22% contribution is allocated among the different buckets that we see in the first few rows.
Okay, thank you. We have any final questions for the department? And we're out of time, but I see Ms. Representative Kopp, we changed our schedule, so we'll bring you up when we're done with legislative finance. It'll be tomorrow, so we'll keep on schedule. And then you could have your comments. I see you're on the list here after Alexi Painter from Ledge Finance. That way you won't be like a rubber band going back and forth. We have any final comments, concerns? Rep. Kaufman.
Thank you. I believe this may be for Mr. Kirchner, but I'm just curious. The 90% funding has been stated to be the goal with the bill, and I'm just wondering, what do you feel about 90% funding? Is that adequate? Is it the gold standard, as it's been said? What are your feelings on that?
Through the chair, well, there's no single answer. I believe the 90% threshold was put into the bill to allow for some cost-sharing provisions that we do not currently have within the legacy defined benefit plans. So that building in some sort of risk sharing is actually an improvement because it helps share some of the uncertainty of the future, instead of it all falling on the state, some of it is borne by the members themselves. We are, so the 90%, we're starting out basically at 100% funding for the subtrusts, the HB 78 subtrusts. And we are, if future experience matches or comes close to our assumptions, we're projecting to continue to be well above 90%. But as we saw earlier this morning, when we looked at some of the a particular example, it is possible, just like we developed significant unfunded liabilities for the legacy defined benefit plans, we could also generate significant unfunded liabilities for the HB 78 subtrusts if future asset returns are less than we expect, or if the ARM board were to adopt more conservative assumptions. For example, we talked earlier about the long-term investment risk. If for example, there was a shift in the asset allocation to a more conservative allocation, less to equities, more to bonds, for example, we would probably see a decrease in the expected, or we could see a decrease in the expected return assumption. Just like we have seen over the last 10 years or so, we were back in 2014, we were at 8%, and now we're at 7.25%. That's because of shifting capital market assumptions as well as shifting allocations. So there is the possibility that we could fall below 90% funding for the HB 78 trust, but there are some levers that the ARM board can use to help offset so that all of that cost, all of that fluctuation doesn't fall directly to the state. But there is a possibility that state contributions could increase more if the unfunded liabilities grow larger than we expect due to unanticipated experience. In the defined benefit world, there are no guarantees, and we have risks that we have to deal with, and our job as the actuary is to help mitigate those risks as best we can from year to year, but there are some things outside of our control. I believe the 90%, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead and finish.
Well, I believe the 90% is a good target, and it's helpful to have some sort of a risk sharing, but the problem, the reason why we see the state contributions projected increase, the problem is because we're bound by the 22% and 12.56. So unless, if we were to see some sort of increase in those levels, that would help mitigate the cost increase. But because we have that ceiling that employers are going to contribute the same amount one way or the other, the difference falls to the state. There's just no way around it.
I think we've seen in previous conversations here that there's like six other pension plans that have the 90% floor, three are below it, or one's at it, three are below it, and the other two are right at it. So there's, I think one's down, one's in the 70s even. So it's nice to have a floor, but you can definitely go through it. We have any final comments before we adjourn for the day and let everybody off the hook? That'll finish up today. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we'll be back at it. We got the University of Alaska's budget request, 9 a.m., but we'll start off with Mr. Painter of Legislative Finance. We'll do his presentation. I think the bill sponsor wants to make a comment or two at the end of that. And then we'll go to capital budget requests. We'll just have a brief Eddie. Okay, come back on. I guess Alexi Painter gets off, and so he'll come tomorrow afternoon. So then tomorrow afternoon, then we'll have Representative Kopp. He can come in after that. So tomorrow morning will be the University of Alaska's FY27 budget request as a full subcommittee. We are adjourned at 3:10. We are adjourned.